My name is Michael Blankenship, and today I'm interviewing Gloria Jean Cohen. Mm-hmm. Is that the correct way to pronounce?
Yes, Cohen, C-O-A-N.
C-O-A-N. Mm-hmm. And this is September the 30th, and we're doing this interview at the Roanoke Public Library.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, is it Mrs. Cohen or
yes.
Miss?
Just say Miss, okay?
Miss, okay. Okay, Miss Cohen, where were you born and when were you born?
I was born in Roanoke at the Burroughs Hospital. Uh-huh. And Burroughs Hospital at the time was the only place that that African American could go. Mm-hmm. And Roanoke Memorial was there, but and it was smaller, but they didn't allow any African Americans at Roanoke Memorial.
Mm-hmm. And when were you born, if you don't mind us asking?
I was born in 1950.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, how long have you lived in Gainesboro?
Well, Gainesboro was sort of like a even if you didn't live in that area, it was the section where everything went on, you see. But I went to junior high school and was named Booker T. Washington Junior High School. It's still there, but it's an administration building now. But that was a junior high school then. And it was one of the oldest buildings I know, and it was named after Booker T. Washington. And it had a graveyard in back of it, and you know, like the graveyard was really something because a lot of sunken graves were in that area at the time. So I think with Lincoln Terrace and all of that area was built over graves of a you know, I don't know whether they were Black American graves or white graves or what, but they were all built over graves. And another place that was of interest was the Black Y WCA. And that was the best thing. It was one of the meccas there because it was a little marble for Black kids to go. And they could do things and they would learn them things. And they had things that happened overnight. Like I went over there and had those little things where you stay overnight, you know. And it was really cool. And so now down the street a bit, that's where you would find the library. That was the Gainesboro Library. Now, at the time, Lena, you know, that was the only library Blacks could go to. They wasn't allowed at this one. Now, and so everybody would go to that particular library not wanting any trouble, you see, because they wouldn't allow them in that library. In fact, they wouldn't allow us in certain schools like Jefferson. Now, Fleming hadn't been built, but I think they just had Jefferson then, but that was the white school, and so Addison, which was built for Black people. Now, this was the only school that wasn't a hand-me-down school. Loudoun was a hand-me-down school. When the whites moved out, the Blacks would move in, and that school was not, you know, and they would give us their old books, you see. These old books and their old tapes, you know, their old little tables that we would sit at. And often we were really mad because these tables had things that was written on them and scratched on them. They were nasty, had gums on the back. The books were all scratched up and you couldn't half read them. But that's the only books that we had, you see. So I think it made me kind of angry. It made a lot of people angry. We wanted one school that was totally Black built and new. So my mom was telling me that the whole community would get together and they would bake pies. They would sell everything they had, yard sales and everything, to get the government to go half in what they could raise to build Addison School. It was the mecca of the Black community, Addison Schools. And they had the Addison Bulldogs. That was our team. And I'll never forget the team. I always wear that Bulldog tag on my, you know, shirt because I love them. They were so good. Now, the black team had all the best black players, and the white teams didn't. So, the thing about it, when they come up against the Bulldogs would mow them down. You see what I mean? Because they had all the best black players. And the white coaches who really pushed for integration, because they wanted those players. They wanted those players bad. So when they had the civil rights movement, them coaches were right in front. We want those players, you know. And so it was, you know, so when they built Fleming, that was the only totally integrated school. And then the black coaches got those black players. They did everything to get them in Fleming. But a lot of them wanted to stay with the Addison Bulldogs, because then when they got the black football players, that's when they really start winning. You see what I mean? And I remember, like, we would go downtown. I think that the Jefferson Theater, that was a theater they did like black us in. So we had our own theater. It was called the Virginia Theater. You might remember that. You know. And the Virginia Theater, it was really cool. They had all the things that we want to it to go to and everything like that. But the Mecca really was the Dumas Hotel and Fats Domino, and they came to the Crystal Towers one time. And I remember people were talking with Big Fats Domino game day. He was it, you know. And when they had him at the Dumas, I think the blacks was in control of that, because Facts, he didn't want to play at any white place. He said, only place I would pay is an integrated place. And this man had, everybody loved him. Everybody, white and black, wanted Facts. So he went into Dumas Hotel, so they made a deal. They said the whites could go there on the rope part, but the blacks would be there. You know what I mean? But they would not allow them. The blacks would not allow them to sit in the chairs to watch Fat Domino, because that's the way they did them for over the years. So they wanted to get back at them, so they made them do that rope thing like they've been doing them. And when that Fat Domino showed up, it was just like the sky rising up. That's what my mama said. And that man could sing, and the whole town would buzz about that man the years, you know, the part, years later, you know. That day he came. And another one who came was Cab Calloway, you know? The Cab was good, you know? And I mean, everybody loved that man. But you know, you wouldn't understand it if you, you know, he wasn't there. But when Cab Calloway came to the Dumas, oh, it looked like the world would come apart, because that man was the best singer and that New York and any place had produced. And he was a really good entertainer. So when the Cab came there, he went to Dumas. He says he would not play for a segregated audience. It had to be integrated, the same thing that Fats said. And so all those whites wanted to be in there. They just took, and when he came there, they was going to mob Henry Street, because they was going to see him, you know, Cab Calloway. Ain't no way they're going to keep him out there, the Dumas says. So he said, all right, you let him in. We're going to integrate this thing, and we're going to sing, and you're going to hear Cab. And Cab, he went, oh, Lord, he went on all night. Now, my mom seen this. She was there. And she said that was the biggest thing in the world, you know, when Cab Calloway came to Roanoke. Now, these are some of the things my mom had said to me, you know, because it was something. And so, but I remember going on Henry Street as a girl. It wasn't bad then. You had hot dogs. And then you could go to Virginia Theater. But beyond that point, that was it. Nobody went beyond that point, because they know they go downtown Jefferson, they weren't going to get in unless they sat in the balcony. And a lot of them said, I'm not sitting on that balcony. Either you let me in or you don't. So, but we got all the best pictures at Virginia Theater. And it was a Mecca. And they had barbershops, a lot of good businesses there. And matter of fact, the railroad used to come through there. You know, the railroad used to come through Roanoke. And they had the passengers would get out around about Henry Street, you know, where that's where we'd get out. And a lot of times the soldiers, there was a lot of black soldiers would get out there too. And they'd come right on up there to Henry Street. And they would spend gallons of money. So because of all that money those soldiers spent on Henry Street, it was the most popular street there was, you know. And it was nothing the white people could do about it because that was established Gainesboro area. And so I think when those passenger trains stopped coming, that's when Henry Street fell off a little bit, you see. And then I think the town leaders at the time, they were Dr. Clater. Dr. Clater was the only town's black physician. And he set the standards for everybody, and he, you know, his family was like the greatest family there was. Everybody loved them, you know. And then there was the, I think he's dead, I'm not sure, but that funeral home, what's the name of that funeral home at the time?
Well, the advisor?
No. I don't know how it escaped my mind. But anyway, that funeral home.
Williams?
William and Moore? No, William and Moore was there, though. But it was now. It was the other one that all my people were buried there. But anyway, William and Moore did pay a part. But all the elect, the lawyers, the doctors, and everyone, at the time come and all of that stuff was over with, they came and integrated Woolworths because they wasn't allowed to sit. They would take the dollars now, but they wasn't allowed to sit in that section where you eat at. So when the big ones showed up, I don't think no police would dare arrest them because they knew that these people were so ingrained in the black community, they thought that there'd be a riot if they touched them. So they ate and they ordered things, and then when they got through, everybody was, you know, was eligible to eat in those lunch counters, you know. And then that Mayor Taylor came along, and he was the so, what you call it, he had such charisma, you know. That man had so much charisma. And the thing, and he became mayor, you know, about around that time, you know. Like, when all that stuff was going on, I remember, you know, sitting in the little TV set, you know, television, where it used to be black and white, and all the news would have those things on, like the stuff like the Eye on the Prize. But when I was a kid, I was looking at it firsthand, you know, not secondhand. And it kind of scared me. It scared me so bad that I used to didn't want to walk to school. See, I had to walk all the way from Hanover, maybe 5 or 6 blocks to get to Booker T because they didn't have school buses for us.
Did you grow up on Hanover?
Yeah, I grew up on the 1000 blocks of Hanover. That little house there, and it was an all-black neighborhood, but they did have white people there, you know. But the thing about it is, it was Lakeside. Lakeside was a segregated place when I was growing up. And can you imagine a kid wanting to go to a little amusement park and they wouldn't let you, you know? So I guess the white kids in the block, they would go to the amusement park, like Lakeside, and they used to come back and tease us, right? So my brother would just beat them up, you know, and it'd be a big fight. And my mom said, well, if you're going to throw the stuff in their face, what you think they're going to do to you? And so, you know, the fight stopped and everything. But at the time, it was segregated. But the first time it became integrated, they start integrating Lakeside, my mother got a job there. And because my mother worked at Lakeside, my brother worked at Lakeside, and all those people worked at Lakeside, we could go in and ride free. So the thing that was formerly segregated then, it was just like a mecca. But the thing about it is, what made Lakeside popular was a big swimming pool. So rather than, they had the biggest swimming pool almost in the South. But rather than let those black and white swim together, they took and cemented the whole swimming pool over, you see. But it was really good, you know.
You mentioned your brother. Did you? How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I have 1 sister and 2 brothers. One brother is deceased, and the other one became a Marine. And he spent 20 years in the Marine as a drill sergeant. Then he went to school to become a teacher. Now he teaches some kind of history. He teaches history, government, and things like that. And my sister-in-law teaches. She's a drill sergeant. And my their kid is now in the April, my niece, she's now a Marine lieutenant. You know, she's a lieutenant. And I guess maybe she'll go to Iraq, I don't know. But she's got a job in the accounting department, you know, and she trained at Conoco, Virginia.
So she's, who are your parents? And
Lily Mae Cohen.
Yes.
She used to work on Henry Street. And when she was, that's before she got married, and my daddy was in the Army. He stayed in the Army like 2 years, and then he came back. And I think that's when she had Carolyn. And she had Carolyn at Burroughs, because she was the oldest. But no baby was ever born at these other hospitals. I think when I had my child, Angela, it was at Ronald Memorial, which everything had changed then. And so it was really something.
Did you have any other family members that lived nearby?
No, I didn't have any family members that lived nearby. But we had moved, my parents had moved from Roanoke. From my mom was in, moved from Roanoke from North Carolina. She lived in Durham. She was born in Durham. Her mother was a Native American Indian, and her father was named Charlie Austin. He was a contractor. And I think my mom came from a very wealthy family because, I don't know where to say this, but anyway, her great-grandfather, Squiro, was the master's son, and in his old age, he took care of him. And because of that, he left him so much land that he was considered very wealthy. He left him the land and just about everything that he could leave him except the house. And so he owned everything down there, and he became a very viable contractor. And when they built Duke University, he was the one that built it and did the architect work on it.
Oh, and what was his name?
His name was Squiro, and it's Squiro Austin. Uh-huh. And so he did all the contracting work in that area, so he was very wealthy. So my mom came from sort of a wealthy family, but her mother was an Indian, a Native American Indian. But when he died, Charlie Austin, who was the great-grandson of Squiro and was a contractor, he became an alcoholic. He couldn't take it, you see. And that's when the family went downhill, you see. But my cousins down there, they're still very wealthy people because of Squiro. But I have been there, and I visited them. They had beautiful homes and things like that in the country. You know, and my one of my cousins, Frank, had a dreppy goat farm down here. It was something. But my daddy came from West Virginia. I went into Virginia Room and, you know, and I traced his family back to 1850. Yeah, they were named Susan and Robert, you see, Wooten. I think Wooten is a Native American name, so it probably was some Native American on my father's side, too. Uh-huh. So, okay, I'm getting off the track here. No, so anyway, they decided on Roanoke because she didn't want to live in North Carolina anymore, and he didn't want to live in West Virginia or in those places or Ridgeway or wherever he came from. So they moved to Roanoke, and that was about 1947, right after the war, World War II. And so, that's where I grew up, like when 1950 I was born here. But when I was born here in Roanoke, you know, it seems like, you know, I just went through a normal childhood, but my parents, like, they was the first one that owned a TV on the block. You know, it used to be radio, you know. I think radio, when they had a John, you know, what's it, his name, Joe Louis? Joe Louis, he wasn't born in that time, but my mother said had an uncle who was in World War I. And in World War I, my uncle, he was a veteran. He was a doctor, and he worked in he was a medic during World War One. He operated on patients and everything during World War One, so he was a doctor. So, but he had cracked up during the war and became kind of what they call that name, shell shocked. And he had a dread big beautiful car.
Sorry to interrupt. Actually, if you want to stop recording for just a second, Gloria, while you're doing the process, okay?
Okay.
All right. So go ahead and start recording again, and she'll just come in quietly, take a couple of pictures, and then...
Now I just hit the stop button again.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well, you're... when you start recording.
If you could tell me about the house you grew up in. What sort of house was it?
it was a two-story house on Hanover, and it was yellow, and we had a big backyard, you know.
Did you have a garden?
No, my mom wasn't into gardening at that time. But, you know, the thing about it is we lived on Loudoun. They did have a garden there in one big house. And the house tore down now, but it had grapes and all that kind of stuff, and my mom did a lot of canning. She knew how to do that old type of canning would last a long time and stuff like that. And they said the house was haunted. It was really funny. But,
why did they say it was haunted?
Because it used to be a white person used to live there, a white family. And they said that the man had cracked up and killed the whole family or something.
Just keep talking.
And then nobody would rent the house, you see. So my mom liked the house so much, she said she used to go. She talks to him every day, and so she said she would rent the house. And so when we went into the house, strange things did happen there. And one time, it would rain. It was raining all the way, and my daddy was in the house. At the time, he always kept a gun up under the bed, under the pillow. And my mother, didn't like that idea, but he said, you have to. So when it was raining real hard, and then somebody banged on the door real hard. And so he went down there, and he opened the door. And he said it was a white man. He was drenched, and he said the N-word. He said, get out of my house. This is my house, and I don't want you living in it, or something like that. And he said, okay. And then he shut the door. You stay here, he said. And then he went upstairs and got the gun, his intention to shoot the man. But the time he came down real quickly, he was running, the man had disappeared. And so he told the landlord, and the landlord said, well, I told you the house had ghosts. So you signed the contract, so you got to stay there a year anyway. So we stayed there a year, and all kinds of strange things. So my mom invited some guests to stay there overnight, you know. And so they stayed there overnight, and then when she went to, everybody went to bed, they said, the woman said, let that child, you know, talking to me, I was a child at the time, said, let that little baby girl sleep with me, because they say if you have a child with you, the ghost won't bother you. So it was raining again, and it was soaking, and everything, the ground was soaked. And then all of a sudden came a banging, hammering on the door. And the lady went down to this door to see who it was, right? And then all of a sudden, the door, you know, they seen the white people at the door talking about, we're going to get you, we're going to lynch you, and stuff like that. And then the time she ran back upstairs to get the car, they was gone, and then she had a nervous breakdown, and her husband ran out in the middle of the night in all that rain, and they would not come back.
I'll get your names later.
Sure. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
What kind of work did your parents do?
My daddy worked for the city. He was where they collect garbage. But a garbage collector then, when everything was segregated, was the biggest job in town. Because you couldn't do anything, you know? You had to be limited. You had people did things in their house. Some people had a house where you go for food. So when the men come out to work, they would fix the food for the men. And they ate the food, you know. Everybody did their own thing. like on Henry Street, they did the little restaurants, but everybody had their own little illegal thing. Like they had one man who would clean up other people's houses for a certain amount of money, and one black man would do this, and one black man would do that. But at that time, they patronized their own people because they know they couldn't get jobs anywhere else. So in the community, had their own jobs. They patronized everybody, and they wouldn't hire a white person back then. But if you had to move, we had a certain person who did the moving. So they patronized that black person who did the moving. If a black person was selling ice cream, they patronized that black person selling ice cream. And by patronizing their own people, they was guaranteed that everybody had a way to make a living.
Well, what sort of work have you done throughout your life?
Well, I think I like to write plays. Of course, none of them sold right now, but I'm still working on that. I'm writing a book. I got to do it over for Doubleday because they want it done properly. So, and I did worked at Bailey's Cafeteria for a while. And I did. I was a bus girl at Big Lots. In S&W, I worked at S&W. Then I went to Richmond during the Depression and got me a job at Hot Shots. But I did mostly food work. I worked at Crystal Towers for a while as a maid, too. And so, I mean, I worked at a lot of places. But mostly just food service work. I couldn't name them all.
What's the book about that you're writing?
It's about living in Roanoke and growing up in the African-American myths that you hear. The myths that people tell you. It used to be oral. They never wrote it down. There's a lot of myths that people tell they never write down. And I remember all those little tales they told me, but they never wrote down, so I just said I'll write it down in a book. Because people, before television, before radio, and all that stuff, you didn't have very little entertainment. And so the stories were the thing. And every time you ask a person for a story, you give them a little something, and they'll give you a story, you know what I mean, right in my neighborhood. So, like a man once told me a story. He said, this one black guy said, I'll tell you a story, but steal one of your dad's cigarettes and give it to me. So I stole one of my dad's cigarettes and gave it to him, which was really bad. If my dad caught me doing that, it'd been awful. And he would tell me stories about things. He told me a story about this guy named Hog John that started the soul food craze. I said, how does he do that? And then but I'll go in the book and explain it. And then he would tell, like, you go to the lady up the street. Those people were really hungry, some of them. And they asked you to bring some ham biscuits. So I brought up some ham biscuits. And they tell me a story, stuff like that. And then it got to the point where they were just begging to tell stories. And my mom told stories at night. Everybody would tell you a story because that was the thing. It was very little entertainment back in those days,
That's wonderful. Well, tell me about your school life. Where did you attend school? Did you have to walk to school?
Everybody walked to school. They didn't have any school buses, I think. I walked to Loudon School. That was my first school. And they didn't have any school buses. I walked 5 or 6 blocks to school. But nobody even considered, kidnapping then. Because it was an all-black neighborhood. And when you walked past everybody. Had little shops and things, the barber shop. You walked by, and you just walked by everybody. And they would holler. And, people be on their porch anyway. So he wasn't scared of nothing. And I walked all the way to Loudon School, about 5 or 6 blocks. And, we had a first grade teacher. You went there to the 5th grade right there. But I never, never, ever caught a school bus. I don't remember why. I don't even think they had them. A school buses back then was low priority for black kids. Everything local. Just like Forest Park, if you just had to do something in that area, right? And so the teachers, though, I think most of those teachers didn't have a college education, because then, if you finished the 9th grade, you was a teacher. You see what I mean? Or if you finished school, you was a teacher. Then if you just had an associate degree, you was a teacher. But the white people, their teachers did finish college. That's why we were behind. I didn't know that we were behind. I was that behind. You see what I mean? But that was why. And a lot of people don't want to admit it, and a lot of teachers, you know. But those teachers, like, were very old and everything. But one teacher that I really remember was Eunice Poindexter. She taught my daddy when he was going, and when he was in Ridgeway. And she was, and my daddy, she was telling me that I would appreciate the school lunch program, because she said when she was young, and my daddy was going to school, that they didn't have school lunches, that the parents had to bake cakes and stuff and bring it to the school, so when the kids come, they would have a lunch, you see. And that's when he was in Ridgeway, Virginia, and then he graduated from Addison as a mechanic. My dad did. And he was one of, like, the first graduates there. Later on, they gave him a job at the post office because he was in World War II, you know. And so, and also, that was it, you know, like that.
Now, after the fifth grade, what school did you go to?
Harrison,
okay.
That's why they have that museum there. Harrison was the only school you could go to. It was like it was all black, you know. And Harrison, at the time, was they had their Hamilton books, but I think Harrison used to be a white school, and so was Loudoun. But when we moved in, they moved out, and they gave us our old stuff. And so then from there was Booker T. And in Booker T, Washington, that's when I started walking to Gainesboro Library. I had to go every day. All us kids, we went to that library. That was everything to us. You know, back then, that black library was everything. You'd feel depressed. You'd feel depressed because you weren't part of the regular life. You was in a world of your own. You know what I mean? You couldn't go anywhere. Everything was segregated back then. And you was, you know, you just like, you was you never almost... I tell you the truth, you were so much in a black world that when you see somebody white, you was wondering, what is that? You know, who's, you know, I didn't see anybody white. Well, you know, it was a long time. Only time the white person I ever seen was the insurance man. You see what I mean? And we used to stare. I used to stare at that guy, and he said, "Why are you staring at me?" Because I never seen nobody like you. You know what I mean? That's the way it was. You never see them. Everything was black. Every word was black. Every person you meet was black. You didn't really see any white people because they was in that section there.
Do you remember Virginia Wiley?
Yes.
At Gainesboro?
Yes. It was a lady there. She had white hair. She was old then, you know. And I used to go there. And this is an experience that I had. They had a little section back there, you know. And these books, and she would get kept it locked. You see what I mean? Because she's, and I asked her, I said, "Why do you keep it locked? I want to see what's in there." And she said, "Well, I'll show you what's in there if your parents agree." And she said, "Time," I think he said, "it was time people know what's going on in this world. You know, we got to keep things hid from y'all." I said, "I think you're old enough, you know," because I was like in Booger T. I didn't know. So she said, "Ask your mom. Can I see this private stuff?" And I asked my mom, she said, "Tell her she can do it. She can do it. You can do it. You can go and see what's in there." So I went there, and she unlocked the door. And there were books in there that I never seen. They were very old books. These were her private collection books. You know, she collect them books of her own. And so when I went back there and I looked in those books, what I seen almost drove me into tears. I seen the pictures of them lynching black people, and the white people were looking around at them like they were smiling, and, you know, smiling, having picnic lunches. And when I went to see picture after picture of that, I think I started crying. I think I started feeling, this is hate. How can I deal with it? They hate us that much, to do this. You know, and I think I had a nervous breakdown after I seen all those books. And then I just cried. I just kept on crying. You know, the tears would come down my eyes. And then at the time, I think they was electing John F. Kennedy. So I went up there home, and I cut on the TV, and I see John F. Kennedy, and I says, "He's going to stop this. He's going to stop this." You know what I mean? And my daddy said, "John F. Kennedy You see that man? He's going to stop everything. He was a senator then. He said, he is a prince. He's a prince upon his people. He said, that's where some of our hope lie, right with him. And so he came through Roanoke as the senator. And when my daddy got there, he put me on my shoulders. He said, this man is a great man, and you should see him. And John F. Kennedy walked through there, and he said a few words about Nixon, and he walked back. And he had this orange hair and freckles. And you know, I seen him, and I never forgot it, because I knew this man was a great man. Somewhere inside, I knew he was, that he was going to change all this stuff. And then I seen Martin Luther King on TV too. And I heard his speeches and all that stuff, and the dolls being put on people and stuff like that. I said, somewhere it's going to change. Something's going to change. And it did. It did about in the 60s when he got assassinated. That hurt me so bad. I thought the whole world was going to come to an end, because I seen it in Dallas, you know, and it had all this stuff on the paper. And I was like in high school, junior high or something like that. And I like to cry myself to death. And then I remember the teacher came into the room. Her name was Miss Cooper. She was very old teacher, and she was our history teacher. And she came into the room and she said, this is something, a great moment in time. And she said, John F. Kennedy had been assassinated. And everybody started crying. Everybody started crying. The teachers were crying. And I remember walking home that day after being told that John F. Kennedy had died, and this was the man that I seen, and it was the great man, you know, to me, he was the man, you know, who was everything. And then I walked home and I said, the dream, it's gonna be over, that's all it's gonna be? It's gotta change, you know. And so when I walked home, I was crying, my mother was crying, my father was crying, and so many tears were shed for that man, you know, because the whole world to them, he was everything. His wife was so sweet. You know, she was like, she wasn't a dull woman. She was so exciting. She had this beautiful air about her, you know what I mean? And it's like Camelot, you see what I mean? He was like King Arthur in the Round Table, you know? He was justice. He was going to be like total justice to us. And now, King Arthur was gone. You see what I mean? And it was the end, and we thought it at the time, everybody thought it was the end of justice. Camelot was gone. The beauty that could be was gone. You see what I mean? And he was a beautiful man inside, I thought. And so, and then we had Martin Luther King, and we listened to his speeches, and they put him in jail and stuff like that, we, you know. But and then when I went to high school, I was in high school then, they had assassinated Martin Luther King. And the whole school rose up, and they was rioting in the schools. And that, but that was our school, see? Now, I don't see how they would riot in our own school. But they was rioting in the school, throwing their books on the ground, you know. And they would sit down and weep on the ground. The students were so unhappy. And the teachers were unhappy. They didn't even try to stop the students from rioting, you know. Everybody was throwing their books down, you know. And they was crying and holding their hands up. He's gone. They killed him, you know. And everybody was so sad. And then so the teacher, to keep the kids from rioting anymore, they said, look, y'all go home. Just go home. We're upset too. Everybody's upset. So y'all go home early today. And we went home, and I remember seeing it on TV, and my parents was crying, everybody was crying, and was just weeping all in the neighborhood. And I didn't think nobody would ever get over it. I know I never did, you know. But when you hear him speak, it was not like just anybody speaking. It was like he would pull you into himself. You see what I mean? He had the way, when he spoke, everybody who listened to him was pulled into him like an aura, you know. He could pull people into himself. He could make them feel what he felt, you see. he had this thing called empathy. And that empathy was so strong that people felt like he was a prophet, that he would come from God. I felt like that too. He was a God-like man, you know.
Truly.
And when he died, it just like a something was missing that would never be there again.
Well, now you were talking about your school before. Were you ever allowed to stay home from school?
Oh, no.
No. Okay.
You know, my mother never. She didn't have the opportunity to go to school because of her mother dying. You know, so early. And to my parents, school was everything, the way to advancement, you know. Missing school and making poor grades was like giving up their dream, you know. They had to work. They had to get through school, they had to go through so much. And here we was able to just go right to school. They couldn't see this. They couldn't conceive of us, you know, not wanting to go, what they worked so hard to do. Like Miss Lucy Addison, who the school was named for, she had to take a ferry boat, and go down a river. My mom would say, "Oh, look at Miss Lucy Addison. Do you think she you walk right into that school and right into that classroom, and you got that privilege?" And Miss Lucy Addison had to go on a ferry boat about 20 miles, and didn't walk 20 miles to get to school, you know. And she said, all those people and back there, all those slaves, you are their hope. You are their dream. Don't let them down. Don't fail them. You see what I mean? And that's what the teachers would say to us. They said, you are the hope of the slaves. They never got to do this thing. They died. And you are their dream. You are the future.
How far did you go in school?
12. And
did anyone in your family ever attend college?
My brother, yeah. My sister, she went to the nursing school. But my brother, and I went to school some, but it wasn't the same. I wanted to go to an all-black school. But...
Well, I was just wondering, like in the evenings at your home, did you all sit around on the porch in the evenings and talk, or?
Oh yeah, we were really porch people. You know, back then, I think, you know, there's not very little entertainment, you know. They had radio, they had TV, but it was black and white, and everything on TV was depressing, you know. But they had all these white programs, like Father Knows Best, you know. And these white programs, everybody in those things was white, and it was like we didn't exist. You see what I mean? Everything was white. I think we looked at Amos and Andy, you know, that was really amazing. But everything else was just white, you know, until you look at the reruns of Amos and Andy. And it's like you're looking at a family of people outside yourself. And I says, what is it? Who are these people? And why am I not? Why not know somebody like me on there? Because I'm part of this America too. And so to me, I just stopped looking at TV to Star Trek come out. Now, Star Trek was different. It opened up a whole new world of probabilities. You know, here they have these characters like, you know, these different people from different galaxies and stuff like that. And they let you open up a world that says, well, you could be just like these people from different galaxies. And they all came together. You see what I mean? And it says, it was like, everybody was Star Trek. Everybody was futuristic then. And I think that show opened up so much possibilities and so much probabilities that, you know, I think it was one of the things that really broke racism was Star Trek, you know?
Well, I was just wondering if there were any family stories in your family that got passed down from generation to generation.
Oh, yeah. It was about how we got to Roanoke. I asked my mom, and I don't think it was the truth, but I asked her, how did we get handed up to Roanoke? And she says, well, I'll tell you the story. And I think she said, Well, you know, my grandmother was a real, real dark woman, and she always said, "My gracious to life," and she was jet black, and she would, one day she went to this white person's house, and she had done her laundry, and she didn't want to pay her the money. So she took the laundry, and she threw it on the ground, and then the white woman got mad, and somehow she smacked her. She said, "Well, you ain't going to live past this moment." She said, "When you go home, we're going to come get you. They talk about the Knight Riders." And so, you know, the Ku Klux Klan Riders. So she went home, and, you know, the house that they lived in was a little cabinet by the woods, you know. And so she told them, "I'll go out the back door in the wooded area, and I'm going to stay here, and I'm going to fight them." So they wanted to see whether anybody was in the house that they could drag out and hang. That's what the Ku Kluxers. So they came in the door. She hid behind there. She took an axe and cut off his head. And she threw it head out. And she threw the body out. She slammed the door and ran in the woods. And then they thought they were all still in the house, so they just set the thing on fire. But all of them was gone. She said, "So that's how we came to Roanoke." And I knew it wasn't true. That's the way she would say it. They were always telling me things weren't true, you know. This guy told me that, you know, we had pig feet and chitlins all the time, you know. And so chitlins was real good. But he said, "You want to know how the first Black Christmas came?" I said, "How did the first Black Christmas came?" He says, "Well, you see them chitlins you eat, you see those pig feet your mom always buy you." I said, "Yes." She said, "Well, everybody likes pickle pigs." I told him, you know. He says, "Well, it was Hog John who done it." I said, "Who's Hog John?" "Well, I'll tell you. You know, back in them slave days, right, Christmas was a white thing. And they gave all the presents and stuff to them, and they would rejoice and eat up all the food, and Black folks wouldn't have, they'd be hungry for a week until they'd stop celebrating." And so this little old guy named Hog John, he used to want to slaughter the hogs, right? So he slaughtered that pig, and then he took out the intestines. You see, the white people didn't want the intestines. They thought they were nasty, and really they were. So he soaked them all in salt water, and to all the fecals came out of it. And then once you soak it, he took and boiled it. And then he made the little old hot sauce that he made himself. And then he said the feet, they didn't want the feet either. So he tried to, he took them out, he had some vinegar. He put all those feet in a vinegar jar, and you know, and cooked them a little bit and then put them in a big vinegar jar. And they called, so it had that taste of pickles. And so he said that the people was in the cabins, they could smell the food from the white people's house, and they were just hungry and just. And so he said that he come in there to each and every cabinet and gave them the chitlins and the bowl and the sauce and the pickle pig feet, and they just feasted the whole week. And he told them the true story of the first Christmas about Jesus, and then he said that was the first Black Christmas. And I knew that wasn't true, but you know.
Oh, that's a great story.
Yeah, you heard all these things from people. You know, back in those days, they would just make up things, you know, make them up, and I would listen to them.
Great stories. Now, what kind of businesses and shops did your family frequent?
Well, I tell you the truth. At the time, we had a lot of Jewish people in there at businesses, you know, and they would give Black people credit, and that's something that other nobody would do at that time. They knew where they were. And so she would go to that place and she would shop at the Jewish store. You know, I think they call him Moses. Oh, Moses. You know, he called himself Moses, but nobody knows his real name. But anyway, we'd go to Old Moses' store and we make a credit application. It was in a Black neighborhood. And he would give us chicken and everything you want, and we ate so good. So my mom run out of money because my daddy wasn't making enough, so she couldn't pay at Moe's fast enough. So she would make little payments, but it wasn't enough. And so Moe's threatened to take her to the took her to court. She did take mom to court too. And my mom told him that my daddy worked for the city, he just didn't have enough money to pay Mose on time. And that she had 4 children, and what was she to do? And so the judge took sympathy on my mom and said she didn't have to pay old Mose but $1 a month. And so old Mose was so mad, you know. And the judges, when they take him to court, they would just do the same thing. You don't have to pay old Mose but $1 a month, because they was anti-Semitic. So they, that's what it was. And so by that time, old Mose, he moved out. He moved out, you know, he moved out the neighborhood. He just couldn't, you know. But that's the way it was. She had these little foreign people would give them credit where nobody else would, clothes and all.
Yeah. Do you have any favorite childhood memory?
Well, I think so. You know, it was this guy. I'm not going to say his name, since it's going to be on tape. But anyway, his name was, well, Earl. I'll just say it. And so we went to St. Gerard's Church because it was all black, right? And so when we kneel down and priest, you know, and stuff like that and everything, and we see the statues, and my mom said, it's just, I just don't like these Catholic people, you know. She said, why can't they go to that other church, you know? And so anyway, she said, I like the Protestant church better. My dad wanted to say, at least they have their own people, don't have to be sliding around, you know, to different churches. So anyway, it was okay until Earl brought a statue of the Virgin Mary in the backyard, and we all danced. He had on his fake robes and things, and we was dancing around that statue and paying tribute to it and kneeling before that statue. And my mom said, Dad, leave that thing. He said, no more Catholic church. No more. I think that's when we started going to Loudoun Church when we was kids. But you know, when I went, it was Reverend James. He's dead now. I think his son is still a preacher. But I don't know. I think his wife, but it was way back then. He was he was one of our preachers at Loudoun Church. Okay, they used to have an ice cream parlor there, you know, where you could go and buy ice cream for a dime. But that was so far back, but that dime was a whole lot back then. So they would give us, you know, I would tell my mom, well, we had to have something for the offering, you know. So she'd give us the dime. And so we'd go to the ice cream store, eat up the ice cream, and then when we was ready, we'd go to church, right? And Reverend James, he had baptized all of us in the church, right? I was baptized. And he said, you know, you kids, you've been baptized and all of this. You know, he says, and you cannot even bring a dime here or a nickel because you go down to that ice cream place. I seen y'all go down to that ice cream place. You're robbing the church and stuff like that. You get those dimes. Those dimes are meant for us. And it hurt so bad because I wanted that ice cream so bad. I mean, that ice cream was so good. And so for a while, I just stopped going. I couldn't get the ice cream, you know.
Do you remember urban renewal and what effect it had on the community? Urban renewal, right.
Oh, well, I remember, you know, back in those days, they didn't have but they didn't have apartments like Section 8. You just lived in old houses that caught fire and was very dangerous, you see, at that situation. But I think the city, when they took, before they built the Lincoln Terrace, they took those people's land. Those, you know, the people lived in the place where the gas company used to be. They had really old, dilapidated housing, but it was theirs and it was paid for. But the city took their land and they had nowhere to go. They were homeless. So they built Lincoln Terrace for the black people, and they built Lambdale for the white people. So that was the first one. But, you know, even though Lincoln Terrace was in much better shape than the old shacks that they had, the city probably would condemn them anyway. They said those old shacks was really bad, you know, fireboxes. But it was theirs, and they didn't pay them for the land very underpaid for the land. And that land is worth like billions now. So a lot of black people got hurt because they did not get paid for their land. But they went to Lincoln Terrace and they lived, you know. But it wasn't the same because you had to do go by all these rules and regulations. You know, you get a job. I mean, I lived in Lincoln Terrace. You get a job, the rent would go up. They cut off your food stamps, no Medicare. You couldn't live off of what you got. The minimum wage was like $1.60, 85 cents, you know what I mean? And so most people, I know I did, and it's a shame, but I said I would rather stay home and take care of my own child than get out there, and they're going to take all your money. You see what I mean? They take all your profits. So that's why a lot of people didn't work on welfare when they did have it. Because they said, what's the use of doing it when they're going to take everything? So I think that, in a way, caused a lot of black men to desert their families, and a lot of black women to just have no hope, you see. A lot of black men left their family because if they stayed with them, they would put them out.
Well, what sort of jobs were available for black folks?
Cleaning. What you called, most white people would call the jobs, they call them black jobs. Cleaning, food service work, and anything they didn't think there was, with no future in. Only thing that an educated black man could get was a job at the post office. That post office became the educated job, because at the post office, that's where the real money was. If they get a job at the post office, they were fixed for life. And then I think N&W, they let them do their dangerous work, like untying those things and tying them back. But you get a job at N&W, you're fixed for life. You work on juju trains, you got it. And those were the most advanced jobs. And then the VA hospital for veterans. Now, if you got on those three, you were fixed for life. It had benefits and everything like that. But the rest of the job was nothing. But
were there a lot of folks that owned their own businesses, like over in the Gainesboro area?
They did it once. When they integrated, those business went to Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Integration, it helped the blacks, but it destroyed them at the same time.
So it destroyed the community?
Yes. It destroyed the community and it helped them. It helped them where they can go out to these white places and get jobs and stuff, but they were making such low pay, it was nothing. And it helped them where they can go to any theater and they can go anywhere they want in town. But it destroyed the blackness. It destroyed the black businesses. I think it destroyed their pride. You know what I mean? They don't have pride anymore, not like they used to. You know, but it did integrate, you know. I did start having a lot of white friends, but my mom never did like those white friends I had. You know, most of them was Christians. We used to meet at this place when I was grown, this place called Sister Potter's. And all those people are. And that's when I got, and I moved in with Sister Potter, that white lady. And a lot of people in the neighborhood, a lot of white people didn't like it, you know. And when she would go visiting around the white neighborhood, she said, you better stay here because they're prejudiced. They don't want you here and they don't like you. And I didn't understand that. But I stayed there at Sister Potter's for about a year or two. I got tired of it and I was working at Bailey's. And then we prayed all night long and everything like that, and all my friends were into it. We was called, I think we called them Jesus freaks then. And we're into Jesus and everything like that. So I brought my friends home and my mama took one look at them and she said, don't you ever bring them damn people home to me. You know, to her it was just like an insult. You know, she said, what are you hanging around with them for? You be with your own kind, you know what I mean? And I mean, a lot of black people who was post, you know, were that way. You see what I mean? Not only her, but they were so hurt back in those days that they just couldn't see it. You know, they couldn't see the whole picture. And a lot of black people are that same way. If you bring a white person around them and you bring them to dinner, they say, out. You know what I mean? Get out of my house. What you bring that person here for? You bring the black person, they happy, you know. But that's the way a lot of the older women now, like say in the 80s or 70s, they grew up in all that Jim Crow. They had never healed. I think I healed more because I grew up in sort of like a halfway integration section, you know, with Woodstock and all that, you know.
Right. Well, I think our interview is just about over. Is there anything else that, you know, we didn't discuss that you'd like to talk about?
Well, no, but I kind of think the churches hold everything together. That's the mecca of the black community, the churches, the black churches. That's the only thing I say. Well, you know, if we didn't have them, we wouldn't have nothing.
Okay, well, Gloria Jean, thank you for your time.
Okay. In the pocket.